Monster Man, Episode 154, Aspis and Atomy. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we'll be continuing our journey through the Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. Before we do that, though, let's answer some listener mail. One thing that's been coming up a lot is ways in which monsters illuminate broader questions about Dungeons & Dragons. So, for example, Mark said about the Nereid episode. So this is a little bit of a tangent, but I'd love to hear or have a more in-depth conversation about the role of marriage in D&D, or the lack of marriage. Getting married is a big deal for people in pretty much every culture that D&D draws from, but most D&D characters seem to run around in this endless bachelorhood, and it's a shame, because I feel like a lot of D&D humor and other permutations really dives into the idea of adventurers or hirelings having families. Gotta wonder what it'd be like to be an adventurous stay-at-home spouse. And this is kind of, I don't necessarily know that I want to get into the marriage question, but it is an interesting look at the way in which monsters illuminate or raise questions about other aspects of the game setting. Also, James Bailey, two-time Monster Man contest winner James Bailey, has some questions about keeping monsters fresh, and I think this is a really interesting point. He said, I was listening to a D&D playing podcast, Infinite Deer, recently whilst ill, and I reflected on this when the DM introduced a big, grotesque, red frog-looking creature. The players, not D&D veterans, had a pretty visceral, stop the monster, reaction. But I, as a listener, had the immediate, oh, that's a slod, cool, I like slods, reaction, and started thinking about what slods can do. And it struck me how extremely difficult it would be to pretend, having seen any monster previously, that my character didn't know important things about it. Would I get my character to make attacks on a monster that I knew would fail, or avoid doing things that would cause the monster to reveal weaknesses I knew of? Regarding the early monster books, I wonder if this helped contribute to moving from here's some monster collections into a more here's an implied setting way of writing for D&D and similar games. And also, I guess, drove demand for the gotcha, this isn't really an X undead, it's a new Y undead monster types. Things like having a pinned-down planar lore for the slots, githyanki, etc. may be partly important in that they give a framework that doesn't require extra plot writing from the DM, in which a character in-game can access the knowledge already held by the players outside the game once the veil of mystery's been dropped from a monster. That's certainly a thing that was true in a 4th edition. 4th edition bestiaries always included, well, I don't know about always, but often included these, like, DC whatever lore checks that allowed you to know certain things about a monster, basically so that you could stop having these ceaseless arguments about whether or not your cleric would really know about a devil. James followed this up by saying that actually one of the episodes had addressed this, so I guess he wrote this before listening to one of the Fiendfolio Inspiration episodes. But yeah, absolutely, I think that sense of becoming jaded and, like, developing consistent strategies, throwing firebombs at mummies and, you know, making sure you always have silver weapons and a mirror and so on. Definitely that kind of, like, rock, paper, scissors element of early monster design is partly what led to this proliferation. You know, once you've got your spear set to bounce to fend off an Eskimoid, well, then some other thing's going to come along and, you know, that variety of monsters was there to kind of keep the challenge and the experience of learning about new creatures, which was fun. And not even in terms of just challenging the players and making it difficult for them, but players enjoy knowing about monsters, but they also enjoy learning about monsters. So I think that that is, you know, quite apart from the challenges of role-playing, whether you know about a monster or not, I think the fact that it's desirable to have that experience of learning about a creature, I think that kept it in the game. Anyway, at least that's my preliminary thought on the topic. Okay. So thank you very much, guys, for writing in. I always really appreciate hearing what people think about these episodes, and you can find the ways to contact me and send in your own listener mail at the end of this episode. So our first monster for this episode is the Aspis, and the Aspis, basically an insect creature, a sort of insect person. They're organized, they fight with weapons and stuff. The illustration here is a little weird because there are three types of Aspis. You've got the larva. You've got the drones, which are your sort of warrior types, and then you've got the cows, which are what, you know, like a queen Aspis. So the larvae are the same, but then they either grow into fighters or into cows that produce more larvae. And the illustration is either of a larva or a cow, so it's quite a normal-looking insect but bigger kind of a situation, but that's burying the lead because the drones are the actual Aspis that your PCs are most likely to encounter. They're the ones who are going to be out there outside of the hive. Anyway, other than that, they got the usual hive mind ant cliches. They don't have individual identity, etc. I feel like the Aspis done right are the ant guys from Quelong, Ken Height's kind of fantasy Cambodia setting. Myrmidons. And there they're portrayed as this kind of like army of ants, you know, sweeping across the countryside, devastating everything in their path. And I think that that is the way you use the Aspis, right? Like, if you run into only five or six of them, it's whatever, right? They're just kind of goblins or what have you with a particular theme or gimmick. And there's nothing wrong with that. Ant people are fine. But they're really more interesting if you're in the path of their migration or something like that. And they're, you know, they're sweeping across the land, eating up everything, like army ants might. I mean, if you're going to make them army ants, you might as well make them army ants, you know? Next, we have the Atomy. And I tell you, sometimes I don't really know what to do with creatures like the Atomy, because the Atomy, stop me if you've heard this, is a little person, and it lives in the forest, and it likes to frolic, and it's quick and nimble and hard to see, and sometimes it will stick you with its itty-bitty sword or shoot a teeny-weeny arrow at you, like the Sprite or the Pixie. However, I mean, there's more of these, aren't there? The Mite is basically like this, although it's a little more evil. You know, the Germlane is a little bit like this. They're just, how many tiny nuisance men do we need in one fantasy role-playing game? I think the answer is some, but also I feel like there's a lot of duplication of effort of these guys. Now, that said, I feel like if we're going to have a tiny nuisance man in our fantasy role-playing game, the Atomy is actually a pretty good one. I feel like the Atomy is one of the more successful implementations of the tiny forest nuisance man idea that we've seen so far. For instance, it's got a really good illustration. So I know I've said a few critical things about Jim Holloway's illustrations here, and I stand by them. But this is the kind of monster where his style really works, and actually the same is true of the Anis from last episode, because Holloway's good at expressive faces, so when you give him something that's got like a slightly grotesque but human-like appearance, that's comfortably in his wheelhouse. And the suggestions for kind of how the Atomy would fight, or how they would make a nuisance of themselves, really work. So they have some kind of sneak attack bonuses, they've got good stealth, and they also are good at kind of like disappearing into tiny spaces that humans can't fit into. So there would be a lot of, you know, the Atomies are all lying in wait in the trees, and then when you come in, they shoot you with their arrows, and then they zip off and they, you know, down into rabbit warrens or whatever, and then they're gone. And you can just imagine this, you know, this little hail of arrows and the PCs, ow, 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 dang it, what? So I think there's more of a sense of how Atomies could be tactically interesting opponents, where you're much stronger than they are, and you can take the damage that they dish out for the most part, but at the same time, you can't necessarily bring your strength to bear, and they're going to nickel and dime you. And I think there's definitely something to be said for that monster. I don't like nuisance monsters in general. I don't know why. One of the emotions that I really do not enjoy experiencing in a role-playing game is frustration. I don't like it in real life. But I don't mind my character being sad or my character being angry, but somehow the experience of frustration is always not fun for me at a table, presumably because most of the time when the character is frustrated, I, the player, I'm also frustrated. And getting stung by these little jerks would probably be a frustrating experience. Leaving that aside, I feel like the Atomy is a good implementation of the nuisance monster archetype. I just also feel that it's sort of mostly redundant with the many other examples of this monster type that we've seen before. Atomy, of course, comes from the word atom, indivisible, so the idea is that these are the smallest possible creatures, and I hope that that's true. I do hope that we're not going to go through another three or four implementations of the little woodland pixie thing, because again, I think there's definitely a place for them in D&D, and I also feel like that place has been adequately filled. I wonder if we're seeing a structural issue here, that there isn't really a way to patch or update monsters, so Anis should just go in the Hag entry. If this was a document that we were writing on the computer, we would go back and put Anis under the Hags, right? Anis is our larger, more powerful variant of Hags. But we can't do that. The book is on the shelves. The book has been out for 6 years. So I wonder if this is just not like the closest thing that we can do, short of, you know, publishing an expanded article in Dragon magazine, to further refine our thinking. Like, the Atomy is just, what if you were running an encounter with a bunch of sprites or pixies and you wanted to be real mean about it? I don't know. I mean, I'm sure that the sprites, pixies, and atomies are mechanically different in some ways. I just also don't care very much because I know that in my game, my players would not be satisfied by running into basically the exact same guys over and over again, and with me making the explanation, oh, but don't worry, they're mechanically different. So yeah, anyway, the atomy is fine, just kind of redundant. But on the other hand, if I had to pick one of them, I'd probably pick the atomy. And that's about gonna do it for this week. We've got a couple of monsters left in the A section. So next episode, we're going to be talking about the Aurum Vorax and the Azer on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.